Hello, friends. This is the continuation of the Light of the Soul webinar commentary series, and we're in number 21. The last one was a three-hour program, it was actually a three-hour program, and I hope it wasn't overwhelming for you. Sometimes it seems best for me not to break the programs into one-hour programs specifically. Most of them are 1 or 2 hour programs, but occasionally there is a larger program. The number of megabytes, well, it hopefully is not outrageous. It's about 500 or so, and I thought you should be able to download it fairly easily, and you can stop it any time you want, and you know where you can pick it up. But sometimes I don't like to break certain subjects I'm about to complete at some awkward point. Well, anyway, we are finishing up the Law of Repulse. Pretty much we have completed it, and as I advised on the Makara website, under Commentaries on Commentaries, or pretty soon on the Law of Repulse Commentaries, there are about 8 hours of programming that I did about a year ago. So that will give the, and they are on the specific stanzas that relate to the Law of Repulse. So I didn't see any reason to have to redo that, and you will be able to consult those very important stanzas and see how they relate to the soul ray that you have, and whether you are in the process of using the Law of Repulse. It does really continue, even after, especially after the third initiation and on the path of initiation, but DK has not given us indications, really, of what it is that is repulse. Well, eventually, remember, the entire causal body is repulse. So that will be the Law of Repulse at the fourth degree. So, but we have more modest use of this law as we attempt to approach the initiation for which we are preparing, whether it's the second degree in most cases, not necessarily in the same life, or maybe in some cases the third degree, not necessarily in the same life. So we have more modest possibilities in the use of this law. Nevertheless, it is something that really can help us proceed with the reversal of the wheel. Once the wheel reverses, I think initially, well before true discipleship is entered, the momentum of the counterclockwise movement continues to increase, and you want that to increase. It's moving against, as it were, frictionally, the clockwise movement. Eventually it becomes so powerful that a true and complete reversal is achieved somewhere between the middle point between the second and third initiation and the third initiation itself. Now DK is going to elaborate here upon some of the laws of the soul that we have passed through. We have studied, he says, an interesting sequence of laws. In Law 1, we find that 3 major ideas emerge. Now, Law 1, the law of sacrifice. First of all, that the eternal pilgrim, of his own free will and accord, chose occultly to die whenever there's the fourth ray involved, and the fourth ray does rule this particular law. There is the decision to be made. There is a descent, and yet not a descent. The monad stays at home, and yet descends as the monad in extension. Of his own free will, the eternal pilgrim, who is the monad, chose occultly to die and took a body or series of bodies in order to raise or elevate the lives of the form nature which he embodied, and which mostly come from the previous solar system. In the process of so doing, he himself died. You could say in terms of consciousness, in the sense that for a free soul, death and the taking of form and the consequent immersion of the life in the form are synonymous terms. Perhaps this is why D.K. speaks of the eternally lovely secret of death, something we little suspect in this world, but which returns to us as a familiar experience upon every cyclic departure from an incarnation. So there is the dying. So first of all, in this, there is the dying, and this is all three major ideas for Law One. For Law One. The Eternal Pilgrim chose to die. That is the first idea. But he still has, you know, the anchor in the higher monadic world, even as that part of himself, which is the pilgrim, is going forth. Secondly, that in doing so, the soul is recapitulating on a small scale what the solar logos and the planetary logos have likewise done and are doing. They, too, chose to die for the sake of redeeming lower lives. So we are reflecting, well, we're parts of them, really, and we are reflecting their choice. These great lives come under the rule of the laws of the soul during the periods of manifestation, even though they are not governed or controlled by the laws of the natural world, as we call it. So this is an amazing thought, that this series of laws, this series of laws of the soul, extend to very high places in consciousness and apply in a certain mode to beings who are much higher in their development than man. So that's amazing. These great lives come under the rule of the laws of the soul. They do have their own cosmic soul on the cosmic higher mental plane, and they have their own cosmic solar angels as well. Their consciousness remains unidentified. They don't come under the natural laws, because the laws of the natural world, because these laws of the natural world pertain to the dense physical bodies of the solar logos and planetary logos, which for them, as for man, in relation to his dense physical body, are not principles. Their consciousness remains unidentified with the world of phenomena. Remember the phenomenal universe that the Buddha talked about? So the lower 18 or 21 subplanes, depending on what perspective we're using, that of the planetary logos, the solar logos. Their consciousness remains unidentified with the world of phenomena, though ours is identified with it until such time we come under the rule of the higher laws. And by the higher laws, what does he mean? The higher laws of the soul, or still higher laws? By the occult death of these great lives, all lesser lives can live and are proffered opportunity, so sacrifice forever offers opportunity to those who are rising and are thus far of lower status in consciousness than the sacrificing one is. So we, in sacrificing, we are helping not only other human beings who have yet to reach the stage of evolution that we have reached, but we are helping the still lesser lives of the lower kingdoms, who are also on their way, rising through the kingdom. So that was the second So let's call it second factor is imitating the solar logos and planetary logos in their higher version of the law of sacrifice. And the third factor, through this death, a graded oneing process is carried forward. We need to, at one, the, well, maybe it'd be better to put it this way. We need to, at one, the world of the soul and the phenomenal worlds, and also the worlds of the triad and the phenomenal worlds. In the fall of a leaf and its consequent identification with the soil on which it falls, we have a tiny illustration of this great and eternal process of it wanting through becoming and dying as a result of becoming. So this is the descent from being to becoming. And we go from oneness into multiplicity go from oneness into multiplicity is occultly to die. Occultly to die. So third, we'll call it thirdly, at one, at oneing. So we have three factors here. The first one, three major laws, law one, let's see. So first factor is occultly dying. Second factor is imitating the solar logos and planetary logos in their much higher expression of the law of sacrifice, yet nevertheless an expression of the law of sacrifice, probably to be considered on a cosmic level. And the third factor related to this law of sacrifice is that at oneing is achieved through this dying. So in the fall of a leaf, well, our consciousness falls into lower areas of consciousness, and we do identify with those lower areas, but we do come to ourselves, and in coming to ourselves, we raise all those with which or with whom we have hitherto been wrongly identified. Now, okay, so this is a good summary, right? We are experiencing a good summary of the laws laws of the soul. Laws of the soul covered so far. In law two, there's continuity here, as you see. In law two, the sacrificing unit from law one, again freely and by choice, comes under the influence of the method whereby this death is brought about. So what is the method by which, you see, he's dealing here with a different approach and giving us a different perspective. By the impact of the pairs of opposites and through his being pendant betwixt the two, why? Because so far he is consciously neither soul or personality. He knows the outer darkness as Christ knew it at the crucifixion where he hung symbolically, and of course he's using the word Christ, but you know, it is more the initiate Jesus identified with the Christ consciousness. CHRCN. Well, no. All right, I'll just spell it out. Christ consciousness. It is not per se the Christ who hung upon the cross. That was the Lord Maitreya overshadowing the Master Jesus who hung upon the cross, but he was fusing, of course, his consciousness with that of the Master Jesus. So in a way, through identification, he too could be thought of as hanging upon the cross. So he knows the outer darkness as Christ knew it finally at the crucifixion, and especially Jesus, because in a way the Christ knows this, right? Where he hung symbolically pendant betwixt heaven and earth, and through the potency of his own inner vibration and magnetism. And there we go, because we're talking about the law of magnetic impulse, has drawn all men and will draw all men unto himself. So we are speaking of the drawing power of the law of magnetic impulse or the law of polar union. You can see that when you use these names and their long names often enough, it does really pay to abbreviate them. So he knew finally at the crucifixion where he hung symbolically, it's the Christ hanging symbolically, but also Master Jesus is not only literally hanging there, yes, but the symbolism of twixt heaven and earth is clearly expressed. And through the potency of his own inner vibration and magnetism has drawn all men unto him, and in this law of magnetic impulse, the higher energies, through this law of magnetic impulse, the higher energies draw the lower energies towards and into themselves. This is the first great idea emerging. So he's giving us ideas emerging. So in these various laws, and this is in the nature of a summary. So first idea emerging in the law of magnetic impulse is magnetic drawing upwards of the higher, of the lower by the higher. And so that's the first great idea. Now let's, these things are important to memorize if one can. The second emerging idea, okay, is what? Oh, okay, we'll do it this way. Second emerging idea. I want to find this. There we go. No, it's always going off. There we go. Concerns the balancing of the forces which have been mastered. Remember, this is a law of Libra, the sign of the balance. So this law of magnetic impulse is a law of Libra, the sign of balance. And the symbol of the scales is here appropriate, and of this truth, the three crosses on Mount Golgotha are also symbols, because the triangle is there, and the Christ, Jesus, as the fulcrum. So Libra governs this law, and, you know, I will say that when I've thought about the, astrological signs of the Christ, and I would say Libra, I believe, is one of the signs of the Christ with Pisces. The Tibetan gives two signs to each one of the great beings, Master K.H., Gemini and Pisces, I think the Buddha, Taurus and Pisces, and of course I simply speculate that the Christ is Pisces and Libra. And certain forces from the constellation can be sensed when the soul consciousness comes under the influence of this law. These forces are involved also in the second path on the way of higher evolution, the path of, and it's interesting, magnetic work. So Libra is a very magnetic sign. And secondly, the balancing of the forces which have been mastered come into the picture. When one treads the noble middle path, there's one way to tread it, whereby the energies of soul and personality are balanced in the treading. There's perhaps another way to tread the noble middle path into being itself, from which the cohering forces and the fragmenting forces both emerge. Fragmenting forces on the third ray and cohering forces on the second. So certain forces from the constellation Libra, he hints, you know, he doesn't tell us about Libra in connection with the path of magnetic work until he describes that path in the last of his explications of the way of higher evolution found in the rays and the initiations. First he just talks about Gemini, later he talks about Libra. Libra is connected with law number one, however, and then we find out it's connected with excuse me, law number two. These forces, I suppose, of Libra, are quiescent where the personality is concerned. Their effect does not register, even though necessarily present, but they are not quiescent. In relation to the soul. The soul actually is a great balancing force, and the soul stands at the midway point, as does the constellation Libra. So this law of magnetic impulse is not easy to understand. Eventually, the great polarities are merged under it, and the lower is drawn into proper relation with the higher, and the higher is evoked, and its energies descend into the lower, and a balancing occurs between the two. It's not that the lower is completely dissolved by any means, but that an infusion, a balanced infusion of the higher energies is sent into the lower when this law is truly working. So there will be a magnetic impulse from these higher energies once they are invoked, and it will draw the two, the lower and the higher, into a harmonious relationship. So what do we have here, basically? We have the first great idea emerging, the drawing upward of the lower by the higher. I, if I be lifted up, will draw all men unto me. And this lifting up and drawing related to Libra is a strong reason to suspect the presence of this sign Libra in the horoscope of the Christ, Lord Maitreya. He is the Prince of Peace, after all, and he is related to the Spirit of Peace, and the great sign of peace is Libra. And the second emerging idea, the balancing of the forces which have been mastered, balanced with themselves below, and especially balanced in relation to the soul. So interesting, though, to consider the, I think previously the claws of the scorpion were what Libra has now become. Several of the constellations were single constellations and then became dual and then returned to being single. I think Virgo, Leo as the Sphinx, Pisces, and Aries are separate, but you can have the head of the ram and the tail of the fish here. Libra, Virgo also are dual, but could be united as single. This was brought up in the discussion in esoteric astrology. In esoteric astrology, perhaps the discussion is much more technical and having to do with energies per self. Here in esoteric astrology, psychology, which was written a bit earlier, we are really talking about the applications of these energies to the human psychological situation. Remember, he's telling us that there is no problem in human psychology which is not related in some way to the response, correct or inappropriate, to the laws of the soul, conscious or unconscious, to the laws of the soul. And then the three crosses are also a triangle relating to Libra and, I guess, the Christ's task of balancing the unrepentant with the repentant. Okay, now law three. This is the law of service. And we really are getting a different perspective on these. I'm glad I delayed talking about them until after the law of repulse was completed and not doing it all in one fell swoop. In Law 3, the sacrificing God and the God of the dualities, so sacrificing God, we are the God, we are the monad, in a state of sacrifice, and the monad between the dualities, it's really the monad in extension, which is between the dualities, comes under certain influences and produces more easily recognized effects. Everything about the third ray is more easily recognized than the effects or the state of the first ray and the second ray. So the third ray, as the ray of the ray of manifestation, is more easily recognized in its effects than the life of the second or first ray, which are occult. I mean, anything that is at the top of the seven, the two at the top of the seven are occult when considered in relation to the five from the atomic plane on down and in the world of Brahma. So Saturn and the third ray rule the five lower planes, and they are more easily recognized in effects, whereas the first and second ray remain more subtle in their essential nature and more difficult to divine. Of course, the word divine is that which is used with the monad and also with the logoic plane. To divine something is to detect its presence, and it's a very subtle presence at that. By his death and by his victory over the pairs of opposites, so see how he blends all this together. This is law one, and by his victory over the pairs of opposites, uniting them in harmony, law two, the disciple becomes so magnetic and vibrant that he serves the race by becoming what he knows he is. This is such an important statement. He serves the race by, well, becoming or demonstrating what he is. So his service is a natural, radiant expression of what he really is. So he serves by being, let us say. And he has removed many of the obstacles which have been veiling or blocking the radiation of that being. So it's not, service is not a trying or a deliberate activity, but an allowing of what one is spiritually to emerge with effect into the lower planes. So immersed physically from the angle of the personality in the waters of earthly existence. Remember, the waters, water is matter. We do, water is matter. So working on the 18 lower subplanes, subplanes, is immersion into matter. Yet at the same time, he is aware in consciousness of other conditions, of his essential purpose in dying for other lives, and this is ultimately his monadic purpose. He has the monad is a great sacrifice, and when you think about it, Sanat Kumara is the great sacrifice for our planet, and the monad is in a way within him and is microcosmically the great sacrifice for every unit. When we look up to our Father in Heaven, we are first contacting the monad, an aspect of Sanat Kumara, the great sacrifice. First to contact our monad as the great sacrifice, or to contact ourselves as the monad. It's not that the monad is different from what we are. Yet at the same time, he is aware in consciousness of other conditions of his essential purpose. So his essence is of being. Being is of essence. Essence relates to being and to the monad in dying for other lives, and also of the method which he must employ in achieving and attaining the releasing equilibrium. Achieving, attaining the releasing equilibrium. So the law of polar union, or the law of magnetic impulse, is all about attaining, achieving and attaining the releasing equilibrium. Harmony does release. This we see with the analogy from music that I've sometimes used. When a chord is sung out of tune, it doesn't fly. When a chord is sung perfectly in tune, some great quality is released. And I suppose when we fulfill our purpose exactly, under the fourth ray, we achieve a kind of perfection which is equivalent to death, and we are released. So DK often tells us of the relation of the fourth ray to the death process. One of its names is the mountain whereon form dies, and one finds one is released from the form of the dense physical vehicle of the soul of Logos and into the cosmic ethers. This is the death process, and it comes through perfection. The fourth ray and Libra are related in ways that we don't yet understand, but they certainly are related. Harmony and perfection bring a kind of releasing death, releasing from the dense physical vehicle of the solar Logos and into his cosmic etheric vehicle. When these ideas are dominant in the mind, he can serve his fellow men. These laws have this effect only as they emerge in the consciousness of the man who is building the Antiskarana and who is proceeding with the science of union. So these laws really do not apply except unconsciously, unconsciously to the personally centered man. So these laws have to be dominant in the mind, so there must be consciousness of them. It's not that we are supposed to simply be driven by them. We are to work cooperatively with these laws. Then he can serve his fellow men. So he's willing to descend, and he understands he's achieving harmony between the poles of his nature and an equilibrium between them. that he's being drawn into his higher sphere even as he is descending into the lower sphere. And I think that should be said. You know, law one has to do with descent. One has to do with descent, and law two with being lifted up into harmony with the higher pole of his nature, which at this point is the soul. So he is moving in two directions simultaneously. And he's being drawn into the Christ nature even as he is descending below into the stifling, suffocating, scorpionic nature. Scorpio, it's sacrificial and it's death by suffocation. But he maintains a dual consciousness. The man wielding these first two laws maintains a dual consciousness. He realizes what he is and releases what he is into the lower worlds. And this is his service. So he dies, he ascends and maintains the harmony between the higher and the lower poles, and then under the third he makes manifest radiantly that which he is and improves the life of all. You can understand how a book could be written on each one of these laws, and probably, you know, one day will be. Master DK has given so many seeds to be grown and nurtured in these various books, and in future times of the new esoteric schools, and when the esoteric doctrine receives the attention it deserves, all of this will be rightly amplified and brought into application in our normal daily living. And I suppose this will be done by those who have a lot of the manifesting rays in their nature, the third and the seventh, because they do manage to find the method of application. It is when the fourth law of repulse is beginning to produce its effect that the disciple is aware of the angel with the flaming sword who stands before the portal of initiation. Maybe we could say that, let me just underline that first, that maybe the sense of not quite, maybe the sense of not quite penetrating the higher worlds is due to the rebuffing action of the angel with the flaming sword. We may not realize that this is happening, but we attempt our penetrations, and perhaps we are weighed in the balances and found wanting, and until our vibration is equal to that which we seek to penetrate, we cannot gain access. We are rebuffed because our vibration is too low. Maybe that's happening more often than we think. So we become aware of this angel guarding the gates of heaven or of paradise, and by that we don't mean the usual astral versions of those words, but we mean that which is found on the higher mental plane and beyond. By this portent, he knows that he can now enter. Maybe when he truly becomes aware of the angel, and this is a look in the glamour world problem for this discussion of the angel and the dweller. But at least we catch the first glimpse of the angel and the dweller at the third initiation. You would think that we, in their entirety, I think. Maybe here we, you know, we see a little bit of each in the previous initiations. Sometimes I joke and say about the dweller, well, you see a fang here and a claw there, you know, but not the whole the whole monstrosity. But of course, maybe by the time we're catching that glimpse, the dweller is looking more like our own personality, and maybe many of the lower manifestations of the dweller have been lived through karmically. Anyway, he knows that there is an entry possible now when he sufficiently jettisons the stages of his rocket, which are too heavy to enter. You know, there's an analogy there as the stages of the rocket fall away and the payload rises higher and higher, the analogy from rocketry. But this time he knows he can enter, but this time not as a poor blind candidate, but as an initiate in the mysteries of the world. At one point, after the third initiation, maybe this is possible, and maybe this is really the fifth degree. At some of the higher initiations, DK tells us that we enter with eyes wide open. And this is not the case, of course, with some of the earlier initiations. Well, we can look that up in the books. I'm not sure that I can find it immediately. Enters, eyes open. Well, let's see. He enters free, he who has known the prison walls. Oh, well, we're getting there. He passes into light with open eyes. Well, we're just about at that point, aren't we? So these are the higher initiations we're talking about. Remember that the law of repulse does not really become terribly effective until after the third degree. Then, and in earnest, it becomes a law of the spiritual triad and is conditioning the consciousness and energy system of the candidate for life within the spiritual triad. The truth of this has been summed up for us in an ancient chant that used to be sung in the antechambers. Well, there we are, in the antechambers of the temples, and some of the words may be roughly expressed as follows. Well, DK, he certainly knows the inner truth of these ancient sounds and songs and chants. It must be frustrating to try to convey to us in our very limited language what he more deeply knows. At the same time, he knows we know so little that the compassion that he has must be abundant, and trying to give us at least something of this inner truth. Sung in the antechambers of the temple. There's a hint for all Masons, and of course in the Masonic Lodge music was used. Mozart was a Mason. He was composing music for the Masonic Lodge. He enters free who has known the prison walls. He passes into light with open eyes. These are the higher initiations. He who for aeons long has groped the darkened corridor, Plato's allegory of the cave, right? He passes on his way who has stood for ages before a fast-closed door. I wonder if we say higher initiations, eyes open. Let's just see. Well, okay, we're told here that we're about occult blindness, and the above paragraph is far beyond the comprehension of the average student, but it will be comprehended by those whose eyes are open to be blinded. Well, I suppose there is a blinding that happens when we come in contact with Shambhala, is there not? Okay, opened, and there's opened. taken the high, and having his eyes partially opened, he now seeks to tread the path. Well, there is some place. I can't find it at the moment. You know, hopefully not reference imagined, but I do believe that, and I think this is reflected also in Masonic work, that there is a time when the hoodwink or the blindfold is not used in the higher degrees. He enters free who has known the prison walls. He passes into light with open eyes, who for eons long has groped the darkened corridors. In other words, he has used the power of touch and not the power of sight. Why grope your way along when you can see, the Tibetan asks. He passes on his way, he who has stood for ages before a fast-closed door, the door of initiation. These are probably Atlantean times. Just imagine being able to bring these things forward as they used to be, and imagine what has been lost over the many, many millennia when we were again caused to grope, when once perhaps we had seen but misused the seeing. He speaks with power the word which opens wide the gate of life. We're talking now the higher ethers. Because life begins in the cosmic ethers, in the cosmic etheric planes. He stands before the angel and takes away his sword. I can think in the new masonry that this would be very useful, the masonry of higher degrees. He takes away his sword, releasing thus the angel unto a higher task. He guards himself the doorway into the holy place, and he becomes then the tiler of the lodge, removing the flaming sword from the possession of the angel tiler, and then assumes new responsibilities to be the guardian, because he is now capable of understanding that higher vibration and must guard the place into which he has entered and those who would prematurely seek to enter. He died, this is a big summary, he died, he entered the strife, he learnt the way of service, he stands before the door. This summarizes the entire pilgrimage of the monad in extension. He descended into the lower worlds, which are filled with the strife between the poles above and the poles below. He learnt through this sacrifice and through the dual pole that he is the radiant self, and was able to harmonize his lower self with the higher, and thus be filled with the higher energy, which he then allowed to radiate forth and use his intelligence to express it upon the way of service, and this led him to the door, because the more one serves and obeys, the closer one is led to the great door into life. The two initiations of the threshold are doors which anticipate the entry into life, but really until the third degree and really the fourth degree, we do not enter into life per se. Well, this has been a very useful, I think, summary of these laws. He has not yet included the law of group progress, which allies itself with the law of magnetic impulse. Their relations are very important, right? The law of repulse with the law of sacrifice, the law of group progress or the law of elevation, the fifth law with the law of magnetic impulse or polar union. Think about elevation and polar union. When we come into relationship with the higher of our poles, And when humanity comes into relationship with the higher of its poles, those higher lives and lights, there is automatically, for the lower aspect, an elevation. And then comes the law of expansive response, which we will enter into, and its relationship to the law of service, both in a sense ruled by the third ray. And it's obvious that the third or outer tier of petals in the egoic lotus corresponds to the third or lowest aspect of the spiritual triad, which is the higher mind. That the second tier of petals is corresponding with buddhi, and the first tier of petals, the sacrifice petals, is corresponding with the atmic plane. And right now we have sort of the sheath of the soul when we're dealing with the causal body. The spiritual triad is the true ego, is the true soul, or it's more really a soul than what we call a soul when that triad is, as it were, forced to express through the causal body and cannot express directly via the antikarana. But eventually the scales fall from our eyes and the lower sheaths are no more veils, scales and veils. Think of that, you know. We, the true and inner monad, the true point of being consciousness, I mean, soul is everywhere, really, you know, it's not just on the higher mental plane. Soul is awareness. Soul is the one consciousness. So we are that dimensionless point of being consciousness. I want to say that because I want to include the word dimensionless. We are a dimensionless point, all real points of being consciousness, a dimensionless point of being consciousness. And of course, when you think that we have no dimension and that all points are superimposed upon each other and are really one point, and there is no dimension of space, and finally we will find that time is a dimension which does not essentially exist. Maybe at the eighth initiation, right? Does not essentially exist. We will find that, in a way, there are no previous times or future times, and of course these are great mysteries and have to dawn upon us with increasing light, but within the eternal now, we will discover that maybe there has never been any movement in time at all. We talk about movement through space, but if there is no space, there's no movement. And we talk about movement over time, we may realize that the idea of eternal duration negates this the reality of movement over time. What I've been trying to work on is the idea of some kind of ultimate infinitesimal, which is the next thing, is in a sense so small as to be virtually dimensionless. And when you add that, you know, it's smaller than any possible unit of space or unit of time. When you add them all together, one of my mathematical friends says you may get a one, and I wonder if you'll get anything at all. If you add together all the ever-lessenings, an infinitude of ever-lessenings, will you get anything? Will there be any quantity whatsoever? Excuse me for going off on the third ray here. Will an infinitude of ever-lessenings amount to any quantity at all? This is something that I'd like to establish in my own mind, and I suppose I will have to consult my mathematical genius friend who lives in Berlin. Maybe I'm kind of reminiscing here, but we met each other when we were like 7 years old or 6 years old, and he's definitely on the third ray. And We ended up in the later part of our life both moving to Europe. How did this happen? I don't know. I'm trying to help him understand something of the second ray, and I think that he is correcting my mistakes upon the third. So I'll have to give him a call with respect to this particular question. Are there any units of time whatsoever, is what I'm really asking myself. Or is every unit of time an ever-lessening, an ultimate infinitesimal, and is every unit of space an ever-lessening? So much so, that, forgive me for this, are ever-lessenings really what I call ultimate negligibilities? UN ultimate negligibilities, no, universes, ultimate negligibilities. Okay. Well, I'm not going to find that, but it's a nice word. Well, my researches have allowed me to find it. It's ULN and ULNS. So are ever-lessenings really ultimate negligibilities? In other words, are there actually units of time and space, or are they so small forever as to be negligible? Negligible. And, all of this is the attempt to see whether all here, all now, forever is operable and how that will seem to the consciousness. Well, the monad knows these things, and we who are in a state of immersion do not remember. And so we're trying to remember, which is part of our union of the poles. We are seeking first to be drawn into harmony with our higher pole, the soul, and then as soul infused personalities under the law of polar union, to be drawn into harmony with our still higher pole, the monad, and eventually to be retracted, no longer in extension into that higher monad, and perhaps realize this at the sixth initiation. These laws of the soul, of course, do not pertain to the sixth initiation, but of course they can be, at least in the way they're given to us, but they can be used by on the path of initiation in ways that the Tibetan said would do you no good to know, or you couldn't know them anyway. And if the laws of the soul in a higher version can be used by the planetary logos and the solar logos, then surely they have applicability far beyond our initiatory status. Well, those of you who know me know what I've done here. I've gone on a little third ray fugue because I realize that this is a unit of work which should be kept unto itself, and that we're about ready to begin the law of group progress, and I don't really want to mix the two. So these laws of the soul lead us to realization, where this very simple, this very terse description of our monadic pilgrimage becomes true in our consciousness. He died and we realize it. He entered the strife and we realize it. He learned the way of service and we wake up to it. He stands before the door and we realize this. And actually he passes right through the door with eyes wide open, which is what we long to do as we receive what could be called, in an important reflection in our life, more light in masonry. Okay, friends, that's it. This will be the end of Light of the Soul webinar commentary number 21. Am I doing it again? I hope this. I'm not doing it again. This is Esoteric Psychology 2, page 174. And we're going to begin Laws of the Soul webinar commentary is number 22, Esoteric Psychology 2, page 174, with the Law of Group Progress. Something so important in the Aquarian age, and strangely ruled by Capricorn, as it's called, the Law of Elevation as well, instead of by Aquarius. You would think that, you know, Aquarius being the group sign, we would have the Law of Group Progress ruled by Aquarius, but no, it is not so. So we will go on to that in just a few minutes. I hope you've been able to live through my third ray fugue. A fugue is a flight, right? Les petits fugues, you know? The little flights into other modes of thought. In my own life, you know, it's the blending of the second and third ray which has to be done. We all discover at a certain point what blendings are required of us. So, very good. We'll start on number 22, and if I am mistaken, I'll let you know which one we're starting on very shortly. All right, see you soon.